Hello, welcome to Dyslexia Explored. Today I have got a professor of entrepreneurship here in the UK who teaches at university and has come out as dyslexic 2 years ago. And he uses the term come out quite deliberately because, you know, it was quite a process for him. And I want to introduce you to Nigel Lockett. Nigel, it is great to have you here on Dyslexia Explored. Thanks for coming.
My pleasure. I'm looking forward to it.
I'm looking forward to hearing this story. And it's quite a strong phrase to use of coming out. And why do you use that?
I think because it's just taken me so long to do it. So you can see by my grey hair that I'm no whippersnapper. So it wasn't until I was 56 that I decided that I would disclose publicly that I was dyslexic. And particularly, I was doing this because I'm an academic. So academics live in universities, and you might think that's the last place you would find or want to have people with dyslexia, because there are so many words in universities. So I thought that it captured some of the emotion of actually doing that. And in fact, I came out really very quietly, to be honest with you, because I just decided that I would do it. And I thought the best way of doing this would be to blog every week for 52 weeks, so that at the end of the 52 weeks, I could say, this is the life, a year in the life of the dyslexic professor. So I had an end goal. I'd never blogged it seriously at all. But what I was trying to do with my blog is each week reflect on what life was like as an academic. I've always worked at really good universities, so I've been very fortunate. And I'm an entrepreneur who became an academic. So I've had a very sort of mixed career, but I've never really come out and actually said, oh, I'm dyslexic. And so what would be interesting to share with you and your viewers and listeners is really what that experience was like. And so I'm very happy to do that.
I'm looking forward to hearing it. And you know, tell us that story about that friend who was dyslexic and had come out in two different ways. Can you tell us?
Yeah, so a friend of mine who's an academic said to me that coming out as a dyslexic was actually more traumatic than coming out as someone in a same-sex couple.
That's some statement.
But I can relate to that. And because I've lived a reasonable length of life, my dyslexia has been worked throughout my life. So in many ways, I can see the enormity of that decision.
Yes. Okay. Let's start at the beginning of this story. Tell us a story, Nigel. Where did it all begin before the blog happened, before you came out? What was life like before? And then tell us, what was the wake-up call? What kind of stimulated you to make this shift? So what was life like before?
Yeah, the way for me to do this is not go back to my childhood and my school days, because we may talk about those anyway. I think more in terms of my working life. So in a sense, I would say that what I had learned to do over the course of my working life is adapt to my environment. So by the time I set up my first business, got my first job, by the time I did my PhD and became academic, I knew all of that time I was dyslexic, but I'd never sought professional help and how to mitigate that. And I'd never fully disclosed it. In fact, it was only at my last job interview, the job I'm in now, that I actually disclosed that I was dyslexic. And I did that in the interview because I thought, well, you might as well know, you've got the dyslexic professor in front of you. And in fairness to my current employers, to them, it was, I think, an advantage. So life before I disclosed was one about trying to hide it, to make it not visible. And so I adapted different techniques to survive in that professional environment, different workarounds. And I also use software to help me every day. So every day in my working life, like many professionals, I'm predominantly interacting through computers, with COVID, that's even accelerated that more now. So most of my working day now, even as a leader, is spent on a computer. So I use software all the time.
So, you know, you were hiding it before actively. Yeah. And then what made you shift in that interview? What was that moment? Why?
I had a discussion with someone about a completely different subject, and we were talking about authenticity. So we were talking about being an authentic leader. And I realized that actually, how could I claim to be an authentic leader if I hadn't actually disclosed that one of the main things about me and my childhood and my experience as an adult? And I thought, well, actually, I joke about it, but actually, I'm in a secure job. I wasn't going to be dismissed for disclosing I was dyslexic. And so far, I'm still in a job. So good. And I thought maybe this is the moment to let the camouflage fall away and just start to do it. And I didn't have I wasn't thinking I'm going to share this with the global population. I just thought I'm going to start blogging and maybe use it as a bit of a cathartic experience to gradually share what it was like working as a dyslexic in a leading university, leading business school over a whole year. And that was the motivation. Time to come out, time to maybe engage with this in a way that might help others to realize that there was something about dyslexia. And I suppose there is something else that sort of happened to me, was that I began to realize that part of the good things that people liked about me that enabled me to perform well in my job were actually about my dyslexia. So I was actually hiding, you might say, one of my greatest assets. So the journey for me over that year was about moving from thinking about dyslexia as a disability, saying, OK, I'll meet you at Learning Difference. Well, let's have a conversation, because disability is a judgment that someone's making on you. Difference is not. It's more of an observation. So I would be prepared to have a conversation with you about why dyslexia are learning a difference. But actually, what I'd really like to do is tell you that dyslexia is a learning advantage. I think dyslexia is a superpower. And over the course of that year, I became more and more confident that that was my position. So, you know, hello, I'm Nigel Lockett. I've got a superpower called dyslexia, because I think that there are some amazing things that dyslexic people do because of the way that they think about the world, about big problems, that actually is a huge advantage. So a lot of things have happened in the year that have reinforced that message.
A learning advantage. That's a fascinating phrase, actually. And that's not one I've heard before much. You know, a learning difference, a learning disadvantage, or, you know, but a learning advantage, that's quite powerful. So tell us, what's happened over the last year?
Yeah. So over the year that I blogged, which is now a couple of years ago.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Yes. Feels more recent when you go to your blog and start reading it. You did it for a year, and that was a couple of years ago since it's finished. What happened during that year?
Well, what happened during that year is that I explored through each of my blogs a different aspect of my dyslexia, and particularly how it impacted on my environment. So I contextualized what I was looking at and thinking about. I was reading more, I was watching blogs, I was interacting with other dyslexics, people were contacting me, I had the odd guest speak about their issue. And I suppose what it did, it affirmed my own story was not unique. So one of the things I would say about being dyslexic undisclosed for so long is I thought I was unique, I thought I was alone, I didn't have a peer support network of other dyslexics. But now, having done it all, I do meet with adult dyslexics who are amazing people, no surprise to you. And so I get that confirmation. But what I would say is that I noticed that it gave me the chance to think back about my life. And if I can share some of those things with you, I think that might be interesting. So before I went to school, I didn't engage with the written word at all. Not seriously. So I would say preschool, I was, you know, quite a creative young boy. I was always exploring. There were stories of me going off and looking for things. So I was an inquisitive individual. I'd got friends. I was gregarious. And I would say largely I was happy. So preschool, you had quite a, you know, I would say a typical young boy. What happened at school, and of course school goes on for a long time, in my case from about 5 to, well, probably 19, so that's a long time, is that I had this awful shock, because as I went to school, things didn't go. I ceased to become normal like everyone else. I became very afraid at school. I was worried about when someone was going to ask me to read or to write. I was constantly being told I was a failure. So you failed this test, you failed the weekly spelling test, to the point that as I grew, I had to, at the age of 11, they held me back at the age of 10, held me back a year. So I repeated a school year. So I became, instead of the youngest in the class, I became the eldest in the class. I then wasn't put forward for the 11 plus. So I failed to be selected. My GCSE O levels were a bit of a nightmare, and my A levels. So by the time I was 18, I'd failed most things you could fail. The only thing I had passed was my motorbike test.
That's hard.
It means you can get a massive motorbike. So I was delighted with that result. But what I had done over that time is I had learned to adapt and survive. So I think in a way I'm a survivor, and part of that survival technique was humor. So all the time I would be looking for a way of deflecting attention from me as the boy who might be asked to read to something else. And if I did have to read and was humiliated, because that's what happens, you stand up, you pick up the sentence and you're just humiliated as people start laughing at you. So I was doing everything I could to shield myself from that. And the other thing I would say is that my school days were not happy days. So I think I was quite sad. And when I say that it, as in one go, it feels quite a depressing situation. But in fact, what I think it did, and what I realize now, is those experiences shaped me into the person I am today. And I'm actually quite happy to be who I am. So I want to sort of acknowledge that those experiences have helped me. So I would say that I am really good at environment scanning. So whenever I go into a new situation, I'm alert to all the possibilities. Initially alert to the dangers of words, but now, of course, I use that technique to make me aware of lots of things. So that's a really powerful technique. The thing about failure is you have to dust yourself off and get back up again. So I've become very resilient, and I don't seek failure. I don't try. I always try to succeed. But if I do fail, well, it's come on, Nigel. You know you can do this. Because I built this resilience. And I think the other thing around being humorous is that you've got to really think quickly in highly stressful situations to see the joke. Well, I use that all the time in my job, in any organization, as an entrepreneur, as a leader, because you've got to think quickly. Time doesn't stop to allow you to make a decision. You just got to get on and do that. And the other big thing, which I only have recently realized, is that being sad, experiencing sadness and what we go through at school as dyslexics, I think switches on our empathy gene or something in some way. So I know that I'm more empathic because of my experience at school than I would have been if I hadn't had that traumatic experience. So that just means that I can imagine myself more easily in someone else's shoes. I mean, that's a really important characteristic as a human being, but it's a great characteristic as an entrepreneur. Putting yourself in your customer's shoes is a pretty good way of doing some market research mentally. And of course, as a leader, if you're going to run successful organizations, you need to really support people in your team And one way you do that is to try and understand what it's like to be them. So I work on the basis that most people want to do a good job at work. So if they're not doing a good job, why is that? Try to understand what it's like for them. And empathy, I think, helps you to do that. So I do acknowledge that I wouldn't want anyone to go through the difficulty of being a dyslexic at school, but I can't stop that. It's happening every day for dyslexic children now at school. So what I would say is there are some things you can draw from that because they bring that forward. So I think looking back, I would say that what the bloggers enabled me to do is to reflect a little bit more about how I have become what I am today.
Yeah. So the main challenge you found, you reflected back on your childhood, you realized that a lot of the empathy and the reading of the room and sensing all helped you be an entrepreneur. What would you say was the biggest challenge you faced during that year of blogging and dyslexia? You know, give us a feel of what was your biggest challenge?
I mean, for me personally, the challenge was actually sitting down every week and writing a sensible blog, which made some sort of contribution to the debate rather than just something rushed off. So I got into the habit of spending my Sunday afternoon, whenever I could, writing my blog. Mm-hmm. So there was an organizational challenge there, but I would say that there was really nothing in my way. The beauty of the internet is that there's no barrier to you and communicating. So I posted a blog every week on my website, and I posted it as a LinkedIn article every week. And gradually people started to contact me. So I would say the challenge was actually getting around to doing it. The advantages for me far outweighed the inconvenience of doing this.
Yes.
Because I was opening up to myself as much as I was to the outside world.
Yeah, what do you think are the rewards of having done that? Because, you know, one of the interesting things that if you're an adult with dyslexia, there comes a point where people ask, well, what's the point of concentrating on your dyslexia? You can read,
yeah.
You know, you can spell check, you can get by, you know, Dyslexia is an issue for kids and that's it, you know, Like don't make a meal out of it. And I remember thinking like that when I was 35, which is 15 years ago now. And a thought came into my mind, and that was, what if some of the challenges I'm facing just now as an adult and the things that I keep hitting and keep tripping me up are actually traits of dyslexia that I don't realize?
Yeah.
And that if I spoke to other dyslexics, I might be able to figure them out, and it might make me more productive. I might be more successful. I might achieve my goals more. What if? And it was that question that just rumbled away. And then as I started, every time I took it more seriously and found some sort of tip or idea and implemented it into my life, it just started to unlock a new section of life and another section until, oh my goodness, I didn't realize how many different ways dyslexia can come and trip you up in very small ways that aren't a huge deal, but a little flagstone on the floor that trips you up can make you fall on your face and
it is.
Hurt your knee, you know, or break a bone, but it's just a tiny trip.
Yeah.
And so I'm fascinated to hear what made you think it was actually worthwhile paying attention to it and putting so much effort into reflecting back on it. What were the rewards?
Yeah. Well, no, that, I think that's a really good question. I think I would first of all acknowledge what you're saying. So I now have the privilege of meeting many successful individuals who are dyslexic, and they tell me exactly the same. What they do in a conversation with the dyslexic, it's a lovely moment because you both know you're dyslexic, that you don't have to worry about things, that, you know, the reserve falls away, and people start sharing their workarounds. We've all survived. You've survived to get here. I've survived. And we disclose our workarounds. So let me give you an example that many dyslexics say to me. It's really hard for them to be organized. They find it very difficult to get themselves to a place at the right time with the right things to do whatever task they're predetermined to do. So some dyslexic would say to me, well, the thing is, what I do is I have a kit bag and I shove everything into it. So I know when I get there, I've at least got something in. I'm the opposite. So the way that I do is I get really organized. Okay. I have to make sure I put my keys in the particular place that I normally keep them so that when I do want to do something, I know where my keys are because I've drilled that behavior into myself. So so even just a little thing, there's no one right answer. But what's really important is to be aware of the fact that this is one of the traits of your dyslexia. And it's really important to do that because you can do something about it, listen to other people, hear their stories like you're doing with the podcast, and then take their techniques. They're not unique. I use a predictive software that helps me every day. It's amazing for me. It still takes me four times longer to write an email than someone else, but that's better because it used to take me 10 times longer.
Yes.
no one would know because they would just get the email. They wouldn't think, oh, that's interesting. That's taken Nigel 10 times longer than me. So this is why, in a way, just as a digression, the idea that we are lazy is completely wrong. We're like the swan, aren't we? If we look like we're trying to look so cool and calm, but underneath our little legs are paddling like mad.
And sometimes we go the other way, you know. Sometimes we're like that kid who's like, I didn't really revise, you know, but you're like,
oh. That was me. Yeah, because you've got to prepare your audience for failure as well.
Yeah, that's right. Because, you know, if you do badly, you're like, well, yeah, I didn't really try.
Yeah.
You know, and that's so often that boy in the class often who's sort of, you know, acting up and saying, no, I don't want to be doing that. That's stupid. Yeah, that's rubbish. Yeah, yeah. What they're just defending, it's another defense mechanism.
It is. Yeah. And I think that would be really important to say to people at school now is that if you're dyslexic, be prepared to work harder than anyone else.
Yes.
It's the normal for you. And watch other people who are deflecting from their performance. What you're doing is you're coaching your audience ready for your failure. Now that may work, but when you get into your working life, you know, think about being an entrepreneur. Who's the boss? You're the boss. You know, it's interesting. 1 in 10 of the population are probably dyslexic to the point of needing some level of recognition. Maybe even 1 in 4, 1 in 3 entrepreneurs are. So, you know, we know the role models who are that way. And what's great for me is that I was a boy at school. I was at a boys only school. I thought that it was a boy thing, dyslexia. What I can tell you is that as an adult, I meet dyslexic, successful dyslexics, men, women. You know, it's not a gendered thing. But I would say that certainly you're right to be alert to the opportunity to modify, learn from others. But what I would caution is not to think about this as a purely as a disability label. I mean, I do recognize we have an Act of Parliament in the UK that means that employers have to take reasonable measures to support us. But I would much rather spend my time talking about the advantages of dyslexia, because I think this puts us in a different place than if we're talking about disadvantage, disability.
This podcast is sponsored by dyslexiaproductivitycoaching.com, which helps you organize yourself creatively with a productivity system for Apple devices.
Have you read the book Dyslexic Advantage?
Yeah, so it was a great book. I think that might have been in the second month of my blogging.
Yes.
And I read it and I wrote a little piece about it. And I've got a dyslexic library now where some people have said some amazing things. But what for me it was, it reaffirmed what I was already experiencing and realizing. So,
we've got Fernette coming on the podcast next week.
Wow.
Dr. Ede coming on the podcast next week. She interviewed me last week for their community and she's coming on next week, so it'll be fascinating to hear her story. I want to hear her dyslexia story that's behind the book.
Very good. I mean, it's a very powerful book.
It is very powerful. And So we've talked about the beginning, the wake-up call, the challenge, the rewards. What I like to drill down into your learning moments. Is it people? Is it groups? Is it a course? How do you find you learn, Nigel? You know, like everyone learns in different ways, but I find it fascinating just to, you know, have you reflected back on how you learn the best?
Yeah. So I've said already it takes me longer. So yeah. I know now that it does take me longer, except in certain situations, which I'll share with you in a moment. So I would say I probably have to just work harder. It takes me longer. If I'm dealing with a lot of text, it is just harder work. And maybe it's reassuring for me to now know that that's normal for someone with dyslexia. I've said already with the right software, I can learn more quickly. I also recognize that I have moments in my day when I become maybe just tired of words and it's harder for me to process. So again, I'm more sympathetic to myself, concentrate on the hard to learning writing tasks early on in my day, and then switch to different types of learning or engagement later on. So if you imagine if I was planning my working day, I'd think, right, I'm going to start with emails. I'm going to start with that report I said I'd write. Right now, I'm going to go into meetings.
Okay.
So what I would say is that I learn about my environment very quickly.
Yeah.
So I've said if I'm trying to learn from hard knowledge, I've got to work really hard. When I'm learning from my environment, I don't have to work as hard.
Yes.
And what I mean by that is that I can give you a story. As an entrepreneur, I was in the healthcare distribution business, and my brother still is in that business. And I remembered a few years ago, he phoned me very early on a Sunday morning to say, Nigel, you know, the computer installation that we were doing, we're really struggling to get product out the warehouse door. Can you come and help me? So I went into his business. It was a Sunday morning. All the staff were in. The new system was not producing delivery notes. He'd got thousands of orders to get out to the care industry the next day. And I knew he was worried because he wouldn't phone me 7 o'clock on a Sunday morning normally. So I said, Tim, give me half an hour. So I walked around the building for half an hour. I talked to people. I looked at the computer. I looked at the piece of paper coming out. And I remember saying to Tim, OK, right, there are three things you need to do. One, two, three. The software company were online and on the phone simultaneously with their support team. They made those changes and delivery notes started coming out of the computer system. So that was just one example. So in that environment, I was learning from talking, reading, watching, reflecting. And for me, that level of learning is almost like a superpower.
Yes.
And I've spoken to other dyslexics and you think, my goodness, if only I could do that. So just because you're dyslexic doesn't mean you can do all the superpower things,
no.
But you will have your own superpower.
Just like a superhero, you've got one particular strength that needs to be married with other team members to have a complete super strong team.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can imagine if you had a team of people who are, I would call us picture thinkers, other people call us dynamic thinkers. So the dyslexia thinking is really about big picture. You can really take on massive amounts of information in very complex, fast moving situations, make sensible decisions, communicate those to other people. But you do need those fine detail thinkers as well. You need someone who can do the number crunching, do the word crunching, can see things through to completion. But you also need those visionary people, the thinkers who are able to see a situation, articulate a solution really clearly. And I see that all the time with dyslexic.
I was speaking to my wife about school and this scenario. You know, often school's very much about being efficient.
Yeah.
And often with dyslexia, our main goal is to be effective. And we are wired to go around that room like you did and say, what's the most effective thing to do right now? And your focus isn't necessarily efficiency, it's effectiveness. And in a way, you could think of it as a on a continuum, on a line. On one side, there's efficiency, and on the other side, there's creativity. And then in the middle, they overlap, and you have this effectiveness, this chaos and order, and you find this middle ground of effectiveness. And some people who are hyper efficient need to move towards the creativity to get effectiveness. Yes. And some people who are hyper creative need to move more towards the efficiency to get the not efficiency, move towards efficiency to start getting the effectiveness. Yes. So there's this tension constantly.
There is.
You know,
and I think what's really interesting about what you're saying there is that I think we might have made a mistake as a society.
Yeah.
So I'm going to explain what I think the mistake is and see if you sense this. What we've done is we've built an educational system that rewards you for fine detail thinking.
Yes.
It doesn't reward you for big picture thinking. So what we're doing in our educational system is selecting out by telling them their failures, by giving them exams where they have to write, all these things that we do to dyslexics, to disadvantage them, just by putting barriers in their way. Imagine if we just remove the barriers. But anyway, so our educational system rewards you for that fine detail thinking you're talking about. So that means that if you're a government department running the Treasury, you want the best graduates. So what you do is you go to the best universities in the land and you say, I want the top students in this class. And of course, those top students to get to that top university have had to have top A-level results, which means they've had to perform really well at fine detail thinking. So what happens is large organizations, corporates, governments, all of them recruit the very best fine detail thinkers. And that's great unless you've got a problem. Unless the world changes, unless there's a pandemic, unless there's hyperinflation, unless there's a climate change crisis. So it's okay to have this type of organization if nothing goes wrong. But you and I know the world changes every day, every second. We're living it now with COVID, with the climate crisis, with the way in which we're treating the planet. So the problem is that the big organizations with all the resources don't have those big picture thinkers embedded in their organization with their peers. And so I think as a society, we sort of shot ourselves in the foot here. And I would argue, I think we need to do something different and fundamental, which is say dyslexics are really important because they represent a neural diversity that we need in all our organizations to make the best decisions. So I don't think this argument is about disability. I think it's about diversity. And whether we're talking about gender, ethnicity, religion, neural diversity, we need to have diverse decision makers who are running organizations, running the NHS, running the government.
And essentially, that is team. You know, we're talking about team, and a team needs to be diverse and to be really effective and to counterbalance one another and bring all the strengths that are needed.
Yeah. And there's a double win here, because I've already mentioned that I feel that my dyslexia has enhanced my empathic skills. I've learned to be more empathic. If you have an empathic leader of a team, that team will outperform anyone else. And I know that as an entrepreneur, and I know that as a leader. So that when my company was doing its best, it's when everyone in the organization was pulling together. And my organization was diverse. I made sure it's diverse throughout. And my teams at work are diverse throughout. My department is, because that's the best way to do it. And if you can be an empathic leader of a diverse team, you've got the ultimate group. To anyone who is dyslexic as a younger person, if you work at it, you can get more organized. You can address some of these shortcomings, but don't lose sight of the fact that you have actually got some superpowers. So as much time as you spend developing your workarounds, also spend in enhancing your superpower. So if I said that my superpower was that I'm a big picture thinker and that I can go into any situation, quickly identify the problem, work out a solution, articulate that, to a group and get action done. That's my superpower as a dyslexic. And the more times I do that, the better I get. So for me, I've got better because I put myself in new environments.
Yeah.
Put myself with challenges. So as well as focusing on the things you need to get better at to overcome some difficulty, also spend some time enhancing your superpowers.
So Nigel, if that's your superpower, okay, we're kind of going off piste here, right?
Go on.
But if that's your superpower, why did you choose to become an academic after you found yourself as an entrepreneur?
Well, it was an accident, as in I didn't plan it. So I responded to the environment. So I was doing, I exited a company I'd founded with my brother and thought, what do I do as an ex-MD? I was only in my late 30s. And I thought, well, I'll go to university because I've always been interested in how technology can be used in organizations to get huge advantage, as well as cause massive problems. So we focus on the failures, but actually done in the right way, technology can be a great enabler of efficiency and productivity. So I went back to university in my late 30s to do a master's. And just by chance, I was doing my summer project, which was important for your dissertation, with Hewlett-Packard in their research laboratories. And at the end of it, they said to me, would you be interested in doing a PhD? We'd be interested in sponsoring you. And my university said, we'd give you a sponsorship. So there I was, coming up to 40, four children, thinking, my goodness, do I do this PhD or not? And I took the decision at the time, yeah, I think this would be really interesting because I was really interested in the thing I was going to be researching. And after that, I began to see the advantages of being inside the university because it's like a playground. There are problems everywhere. And since I love problems in the nicest possible way, then there were lots of things for me to do. And most people look at universities as very bureaucratic, system lockdown things. And of course they are, but there are also lots of gaps. And as a dyslexic, I can see the gaps. So I can get things done by going not against the system, but beside the system. And whenever I've been involved in university management, it's tended to be in order to achieve higher performance for the group that I'm in. And I enjoy that. It's tremendously rewarding.
Fascinating. So Nigel, final quest. Oh, no, I should ask you.
Yeah.
Mind mapping. Okay. Oh, I teach kids a dyslexic way of mind mapping. And I'm fascinated to hear what people's experience of mind mapping has been throughout their dyslexia journey. What's your experience been of mind mapping through your journey?
Well, I'm glad you asked me that question because my only experience of mind mapping is watching my children do it as they progress through education. So I noticed my children, and they're adults now, mind map before they do an essay. Now, I've never done mind mapping.
Wow.
So the way that I work is in my head. So if I come across a really difficult problem, I will draw the problem on a single piece of paper. Everything I can do about that problem, I'll do on a single piece of paper. I might share it with somebody, say, what do you think? And then from that, I will then work out my solution and then explain that to whoever I'm with.
Okay, so when you say draw a problem on one sheet of paper, what do you mean by draw the problem?
Well, literally, I would draw a picture, maybe have a simple word, another picture, looking at relationships, looking at the issue. And then from that, I would make sure I've got all there is to know about that issue on a single piece of paper that I could share. And then from that, I think, OK, I know enough to make a decision. Of course, I could wait and make till I learn 100%. But actually, often you can make a decision based on much less than full information. And you make relatively good decisions.
Fascinating. So you're basically mapping it out in some rudimentary way onto one sheet of paper, which is a mind mapping discipline. It's like, can you get this all onto one sheet of paper so you can picture the whole thing in one go?
Yes.
Rather than sheet after sheet after sheet of lots of lists.
Oh, yeah. Because how do you
keep them all in your head?
Yeah. So if you've got a difficult situation, if you can put it on one, and it doesn't take one drawing, it takes multiple times. Did you get it right? Share it. And then everyone has a shared understanding of what the real problem is. Yeah. So if you've got four or five people looking at the same picture and they say, oh, Nigel, you missed a bit here. Why not add this in? Then you think, oh, great, that's good. Is this the problem? Yes, we're all agreed. Okay, can I propose a solution?
Yes.
And that's when you get everybody around the table, the fine detail thinkers, the big picture thinkers, actually agreeing on what the problem is and what the most appropriate action to take to resolve it is.
Fantastic. So you've given quite a lot of advice along the way, so I'm going to skip to the final question. Question 9, tools for organizing your dyslexia, gadgets, apps, whatever. What's in your tool bag?
Okay, I've got electronic tool bags and a physical tool bag. Okay, so I organize my life through my email inbox. So that's really good for me because everything that needs actions is still in my inbox. When I've taken the action, it's in a folder. And the other thing I do is I use one of these. So I've got I've got my electronic to-do list there, and I've then got my physical to-do list. It's very messy, but it's my action list. And so I work in those two dimensions all the time. And that's my sort of way of organizing myself. I've become more and more organized because I know that's a barrier to my performance. The other thing I do is I use Claro Read for Mac. So I'm a Mac user for years now. The university's all on PCs, but I'm a Mac user. And Claro Read is the best thing that I found. And it helps me in lots of different ways, but principally when I'm writing. And I'm writing all the time. Emails, documents, reports, academic papers. So for me, it's my super tool.
So Claro Read, you know, just to help listeners understand this, because many of the listeners, you know, I've heard some professionals, they're designers that think, I actually think I might be dyslexic and I'm just thinking about this and so on. So let's not have any assumed knowledge here. You know, why would you use a reader?
Okay. So I use it for two reasons.
Because you can read.
Yeah. Two reasons. One is because when I start typing, I often don't know the second letter. So if I was typing the word dyslexia, I get the D straight away. The next letter is immediately a challenge for me. Dis. Is that I? Is it Y? It's normally I, but it might be Y. So when I'm typing, what's happening is on my screen at the same time is the best guess of the word that I'm typing. And that best guess is often, I like it sorted by frequency that I use the word. Okay. So if I put DY into my computer, dyslexia will appear as the most typed in word that starts with DY for me. And I just hit function F1 and it drops it into the sentence.
Okay.
So that's really useful. The other thing I do is I play back all the time. And I copy the sentence or I hover over the sentence and it reads it back to me. And that's so important. It doesn't solve every problem. It doesn't solve the there problem.
No.
But it does mean that my sentences make sound sensible, even if I might have the wrong word. And I'm getting a little bit better. But every time I think I've completed something, I email something, I might reread the email and think, oh, I missed that. So it's never 100%, but it's good enough. And most people don't notice I'm dyslexic in my emails.
Okay. What else is in your bag?
In terms of my work, I would say that. I don't feel as alone now as I used to as a dyslexic, because I've met people like yourself, other really, really good people. And I realized that actually it's not just me. There's a bit of a group. So if I had a really big problem, I know I could approach some of these people.
So in terms of you on your journey, you've got your bag of tools and you've got companions.
I think so.
Yeah.
It's not a lonely journey anymore.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Nigel, it has been so great chatting with you in this podcast. I'm going to put all of your links in the blog posts, links into the show notes for listeners to go and find out more. Before we say goodbye, is there anything, any other final thoughts you'd like to share, experiences?
Yeah, so the final thing I would say is if I could meet my younger self again.
Yeah, so, I didn't ask you that. I should have, if you
no,
could.
No, but don't worry, because when I was eight, I went to boarding school, and that was when that was an issue, but actually that's the first time I really struggled with words, because it was a much more structured environment. I was seven going on eight. I was just eight when I arrived. And if I could meet that young boy again, about to experience the trauma of 10 years of education, I would try to say to them, you know, it's going to be tough. I'm not going to pretend to you. You're about to have a really tough decade, but you will come through it. And that you have got a superpower. So if people are going to tell you you're stupid, thick and lazy for the next 10 years, you're not. You will emerge from this, and your dyslexia will be a good friend to you, and it will help you to help other people. So look after your dyslexia and recognize that it will be an advantage to you in later life.
Thank you for that. I was that eight-year-old boy at boarding school as well.
Tough.
It is. Out of interest, when you're under that much stress, when anyone's under that much stress, it's like an egg. You put it under pressure, it starts to show up wherever the weak natural weak spots are. My personal weak spot was my eczema.
Stress
flared up my eczema. So school was all about how to deal with this eczema, which actually it was the dyslexia that was flaring the dyslexia up. It was the dyslexia that was flaring the eczema up when I look back on it. If it's not too personal a question, on reflection, did you see any signs of that stress physically, or where did that show up in your life?
Well, I don't think I had a physical manifestation. I think to me, it was I experienced humiliation throughout my school life. And I suppose that was the hardest thing to overcome as an adult, because you have to just rebuild and rebuild and rebuild. So I think probably for me, that humiliation has resulted in probably a determination to do things and address things. You can't solve every problem. Sometimes you've got to admit you're not the right person at the right time. That's okay. But fundamentally, I think that it has enabled me to be more determined, and I'm much more determined now. I get involved in all sorts of things. I've been involved in charities, social enterprises, businesses, universities, all sorts of things. And I'm much more determined to get things done. But I think at the time, the humiliation was the hardest thing to bear.
Yeah. Okay. And final question, because we have this shared, I remember at boarding school, there was a few safe places for me. And one was the art room.
Mm.
The other was the woodworking room.
Wow.
And the other was, you got, if you wanted to, you could get this little plot of land, like a little allotment that you could grow things in, you know. And I negotiated this deal with my mother and dad, father. And I said, look, Mom, instead of playing the piano, can I go out and have, because the piano was a nightmare for me, the coordination, I couldn't do it.
Yeah, I agree.
It was just torture. I said, look, I'm not just going to go away and be lazy. I'm going to go and garden. Can I garden? And so I started to garden. My strawberries and so on. And we never got enough food at school and stuff like that. I was always hungry.
That's right.
And, you know, we had strawberries and all sorts in there. Wow. And it was my, that was.
That would have made you so popular when come harvest time.
Well, kids would come and steal it. But anyway, what was your kind of, what were your kind of escape?
Yeah, places? I would say something I appreciated at that time, and I didn't realize it, and it's interesting you've asked me that question. I really love nature.
Uh-huh.
So for me, trees, animals, flowers, it's, for me, it's just a, it's a really beautiful experience to be close. So my favorite place in the world would be a botanical garden. And I love going to Kew Gardens. So every couple of years, I try and make my time to go and have, and it's a place of great solitude, but also you're not alone because all the trees are there, all the flowers are there. And I find it very, a really peaceful place to reflect on the important people on my, who are no longer with me in my life, but are important to me, and also to just connect with that. So I wonder whether that that appreciation of nature started sitting under the beech tree at boarding school, trying to find a beech tree nut I could eat because I was so hungry.
We used to raid the neighboring farmers' turnip fields.
I'm not eating turnips.
Eat raw turnip because we were so hungry. It was terrible, you know. Money pinching. Anyway, Nigel, it's been fantastic chatting.
Great to.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, and thanks so much.
This podcast is brought to you by Bullet Map Academy. We help children organize their thoughts creatively and unlock their dyslexic potential with the world's first online dyslexia school for study skills. Thank you for listening. Please like and leave a podcast review so other parents can find it. Visit our website and join our newsletter for updates at bulletmapacademy.com. Thanks for listening. See you next time. This podcast is sponsored by dyslexiaproductivitycoaching.com. It's my day job when I'm not hosting this podcast. Tell me, do you know what you want to achieve in the workplace, but you're struggling with how to achieve it? Maybe you suspect some traits of dyslexia are getting in the way. Well, that's where Dyslexia Productivity Coaching comes in, because we give you a simple productivity system for your Apple devices that harnesses the creativity that comes with your dyslexia. It includes proven methods like note-taking, reminders, speech-to-text, mind mapping, and more, all tailored to your needs. It'll free up your time and help you achieve outstanding results. Book a complimentary call to discuss it with me, and if you do it soon, I may also be available to coach you personally via Zoom. So don't be shy, go to dyslexiaproductivitycoaching.com or swipe up and book it now.